So when did you decide that your Roanoke Times stories on the furniture manufacturing business in Southside needed to become a book?
Well, I went down there to do a series on the aftermath of globalization because, you know, that region has lost half of its workforce. And I wanted to see how those people were doing now. And in the course of doing my pre-interviews, a friend who owns a furniture store said, you know, there's still this guy making furniture, and he's in Galax, and his name's John Bassett, and he was from that Bassett family, and he had been elbowed out of the company by an older brother-in-law years earlier and had sort of emerged still with a big chip on his shoulder about what had happened to him and had really taken his company, Vaughn Bassett, to a new level. And so that when the imports came on and he saw or he thought that the Chinese were dumping, he decided to take it on. And I knew immediately that it was a bigger story than just a newspaper article because you could tell the story of what happened in this country in the last 15 years through one person, one family, two different companies, and two very different responses to globalization.
So how long did you work on the book, Beth? I know your research even took you to Indonesia at one point.
Yeah. I started, late 2011. The article ran in February of 12. I sold the book that May. I had about a year to write the first draft, basically, and then we edited it for, call it, the next 6 months. And, you know, it just takes a while for the book to get produced and came out just a week ago.
And you're getting some great early reviews. Janet Maslin, New York Times, some Pulitzer Prize winners have weighed in on it. Are you pleasantly surprised or pleased?
I am surprised. I'm totally surprised. You know, you write something, and I mean, I've read it and worked on it for hours and hours and hours, and I can't tell if it's any good. I think it's interesting, but I go, oh, that chapter maybe is too long, or, you know, what, you just second guess yourself. So I'm really surprised that people find that it's a story they can fall into.
That's really the thing about writing, and I haven't written a book. I've written lots of articles, and you sometimes, unless you get feedback, you don't really know. You think it's really good, but you're not really sure if
right.
It's connecting
my husband,
with people.
My husband's really nice to me about it, but he's my husband, so.
This is true. You know, when politicians, we're talking with Beth Macy, the author of Factory Man. Beth, when politicians talk about the loss of manufacturing jobs or bringing them back to America, especially more routine type factory work, based on what you've seen in your research, is it realistic that a lot of these types of low-wage, low-tech jobs, let's say like furniture, is going to come back to America?
Well, John Bassett would say it's probably not unless you stayed here and didn't leave to begin with. What you see in furniture that stayed is things that are more custom produced, like kitchen cabinetry, which has to be made because everybody's kitchen's a different size. Upholstery fabrics. Bassett Furniture has a very successful retail chain of stores called Bassett Home Furnishings, and the customer can go in the store and she can order, you know, a sofa made in three different fabrics, and they still have one factory in Newton, North Carolina, that will make that custom order and deliver it to her in 30 days. So that kind of stuff is still going to stay. But in terms of the lower wage, you know, the mass production, it's Vaughn Bassett and maybe one other plant in North Carolina, and that's it for furniture.
And Vaughn Bassett is where JB3 kind of hung a shingle after he was sort of elbowed out of Bassett Furniture. But it's interesting in the book to see the rise of Bassett Furniture, acquiring different companies, opening different plants. And really, Bassett was really a company town. They more or less ran the town. And then it all sort of came to a screeching halt one day. I mean, it's at a point where they were even having the Chinese and people from Asia come to tour the factories. All these people were taking pictures. What was it? The one worker said, what are all them little people doing in there? And then they turn around and start knocking this stuff off. It all kind of came to a screeching halt. Bassett Furniture, a lot of those the furniture jobs, they sort of took away from Grand Rapids, Michigan area, mm-hmm. brought them down to Bassett. And then, you know, eventually that stuff got offshore to China. And then when wages became higher in China, some of it went to Vietnam and then Indonesia. Is this just the way it's going to be? I mean, is it just natural that that's what's going to happen, especially when it's a low-tech, low-wage manufacturing job? This is just the way it's going to be.
I think it is the way it's going to be. And it was really fascinating to me when I interviewed those workers in Indonesia, and some of the plants were probably not unlike Bassett Furniture from 1930, you know, the conditions were a little rough, and I talked to the workers, and they were, you know, grateful to be able to work indoors for the first time and to join that cash economy just like the former sharecroppers and, you know, subsistence farmers did in Bassett in 1902. So you could say that is the way of the world, but I think what makes John Bassett's story different is that he looked at what was happening when the Chinese imports came in, and he said, guys, they're not following the rules. He actually went, he traveled to northern China, looked the guy in the eye, and this guy was both a factory owner and a Communist Party official, and he says, you must close your factories and put your business in my hands. because I'm selling this product for so cheap that I'm doing that to capture your market share, and I can do that because the government subsidizes me. And that's a violation of the WTO laws. And he just looked him plainly in the face and said it. And that's when he went back home and he said to his sons, first, my grandfather would roll over in his grave if I closed all my factories because somebody was telling me to do that. And I'm going to take him on. I'm going to fight back.
And he did. JB3 went all the way to Washington, got he needed to get a majority, I guess, of furniture builders to sign on, and they went after, and they got tariffs.
They got duties, actually.
Duties.
They're called duties.
Okay.
And they won their case, a 6-0 slam dunk in 2005, and then when the review came up in 2010, they won it again. And the money that they got from the duties, you know, he plowed right back into his factory. Not everybody that joined his coalition did. A lot of those factories closed anyway, and they decided to put more money into importing and, in the case of Bassett Furniture, into their retail.
Mm. In a nutshell, we're talking with Beth Macy, the author of Factory Man, How One Furniture Maker Battled Offshoring, Stayed Local, and Helped Save an American Town. Why, in a nutshell, what happened with JB3 and Bassett Furniture and his brother-in-law, I guess Bob Spillman, what happened that he wound up getting shunted aside?
Right. Well, so he went to college, he went to W&L, and then he was in the Army for 6 years. And when he came back from Germany, his father was running the business. His father, Doug Bassett, was CEO. And his brother-in-law, Bob Spillman, was 10 years his senior. And it was really, you know, impressive to Doug and to the other members of the family that were running the company. He was an impressive guy. He had worked at Cannon Mills in New York. And one of my quotes I love, that they said, you know, Bob's already been to California and Bill and I haven't even been there yet. So there's a little bit of like they were impressed by the sophistication. And he was a hard-charging, you know, executive and very cocky. And when John's father was, you know, unexpectedly, tragically diagnosed with stage 4 cancer and died before anybody, you know, before there was a real succession plan, it happened that their cousin Ed Bassett became CEO, and he quickly joined alliances with Bob Spillman, sort of in part to get back at Doug. I mean, it's a family business.
Right.
It's fraught like every family business, like every family, really.
It's like,
you know,
dynasty,
it's like,
or something.
It's like we all have dysfunctional families, only this one had a lot of power and a lot of money.
So JB3 went on to Vaughn Bassett, basically, in Galax. He's kept hundreds of people working. I guess he's in his 80s now?
No, he's 76.
76.
He still works every day. He is in touch with every detail of that business still. He sleeps with a legal pad next to his bed. He calls workers in the middle of the night. He has a million ideas for how to keep that factory going. And he's not making a ton of money right now, you know, breaking even, basically. But he has a balance sheet that he says is like the Rock of Gibraltar. And he can keep that factory open for as long as he chooses.
So what's your impression of JB3? What did you come away thinking about John Bassett III?
Oh, I think he's eccentric. I think he's a prickly protagonist, as someone called him. Definitely. We've been through all the emotions. We've loved each other and hated each other. And he can be very difficult, but I think he's got a big heart for those 700 workers in Galax. I think he's got a lot of pride in his family name. Partly, I think he wants to show the folks back in Bassett that Little John, as they still call him dismissively, knows how to be the factory man.
Well, Bassett Furniture, when they got started in, again, a lot of low-wage jobs, they sort of controlled the town. I guess they really owned a lot of the places people lived and all that. And people didn't make a whole lot of money. I mean, but was it Bassett Furniture, Beth, was it good for Southside Virginia, ultimately, and for those people?
Well, I've interviewed a lot of people, and they say, you know, African-Americans in particular have said over and over, they said, it brought us out of sharecropping. And it allowed me to go to college. I was the first person in my family to go to college. I heard that over and over. I mean, even the domestic workers that I interviewed, some of their descendants, they were able to send their kids to college for the first time. Naomi Hodge-Muse, who's now a retiree and was a very successful manager at Miller Brewing and had gone to college, you know, said she was able to be inspired to be a chemistry major because her mother, who was a Bassett family maid, put on layaway her first chemistry set, and she won, you know, a science fair project, and that kind of launched her. So, yeah, I mean, they were low wage jobs, and I think the lesson here is really, like, they have Martinsville and Henry County, which was in the 60s, it was said to be the home to the most millionaires per capita in the country, but they had all their eggs in these two baskets of textiles and furniture. First the textiles went, then the furniture went. And you can say globalization is a some gain for everybody, but the benefits are pretty shallow. The people that gained the most from that were the shareholders of these public companies and the people running them. But the people, especially in those areas that were heavily impacted by trade and were heavily industrialized and heavily harmed by offshoring through no fault of their own, those communities, I think, will be decades coming back.
Before I let you go, your mom was a factory worker, so did you sort of relate to the story even more?
Oh, my God, yeah. My family was very kind of lower middle class, and my mom worked for the factory in Urbana, Ohio, which made airplane lights, and it was one of those kind of, I grew up in the 70s, and the economy was up and down, a lot down, and she would get laid off, and so I knew what it was like when these displaced workers would give me their phone numbers, and then they'd say, well, my phone's about to get cut off. Here's my mom's number just in case. And, you know, I remember sitting around eating dinner and them talking about maybe our heat would get cut off. So those are my people.
Beth Macy reads a passage from her book, Factory Man, about John Bassett III, JB3.
For the next several years, John Bassett would take his flag-waving show on the road dozens of times, to Rotary clubs, coalition meetings, and Washington hearings. He gathered letters from politicians on both sides of the aisle. He got celebrities from Southern Furniture Region roots, race car driver Richard Petty and artist Bob Timberlake, to give their blessings in front of the media. In a testimony before the House Ways and Means Subcommittee on Trade, filmed by C-SPAN, John Bassett drew an analogy between unfairly priced Chinese furniture and one of his hometown specialties, moonshine. He took the eminent audience back to his Bassett youth, where bootleggers produced some of the finest and cheapest liquor around. It was illegal, he boomed, but when the ox getting gored by it was the federal and state government, they did something about it. The gallery chuckled. Very illustrative, a New Jersey congressman noted. It was folksy, funny, and memorable, his delivery pitched to convey that he was a foreigner himself of sorts, one who just landed in Washington with a dispatch from the real world.
Interesting. Last question, and we talk with Beth Macy, the author of Factory Man. What do you hope readers walk away from when they read this book? What's the lesson here?
Part of the lesson is that in the late 90s and in the aughts, when we were debating whether or not to let China join the WTO, it was predicted that it would be a win-win for everybody in the United States, that we wouldn't lose any jobs. President Clinton actually said we wouldn't lose any jobs, that what would happen is we would expand our manufacturing to export to the growing Chinese middle class, consumer class. And that did not happen. I mean, you can just drive through Henry County, people, and you can see that that did not happen. And I think one of the strongest takeaways that I took from the book was that nobody is minding this new global store, and that it takes an outlier, someone like John Bassett, who runs a privately held company and has this particular set of circumstances where he has millions in the bank that he can invest in this lawsuit or this coalition petition. And he can really take it on because he wants to do it. He does not want to turn tail and run from the Chinese. He's going to compete against them and prove that they're illegally dumping.
Beth Macy is author of Factory Man, How One Furniture Maker Battled Offshoring, State, Local, and Helped Save an American Town. And Beth, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, it was great.